You're with John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
Thank you for joining us on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and around the world. Ben Witherington III is a historian and a theologian. He's a professor of New Testament interpretation at Asbury Theological Seminary of Wilmore, Kentucky, in Australia last year. We've caught up with him by telephone for this hour. Why? Because Ben Witherington's going to advise us on the much-used and abused term evangelicals. This week, the Reformed Evangelicals of Sydney have had an influence on Anglicanism worldwide, threatening a split but not a complete separation of the Anglican Church. In this hour, Ben Witherington is going to unpack evangelicalism for us in its many facets. Following Ben Witherington, the Midnight Inquisition, a postcard, and Frank Sheehan in the Church Room. You're on Sunday night. A little music now to introduce Ben Witherington III. Music of Gladiator. Music of Hans Zimmer and Lisa Gerrard from the 2001 movie, starring, of course, Australia's own Russell Crowe. It's a selection of our guest, Ben Witherington III. Ben Witherington III, Bible scholar at Asbury Seminary in the United States in Kentucky, the bluegrass country. Ben Witherington is also one of those who's studied evangelicalism, that diverse and loosely structured term which is applied to so much of the church these days with so often so little understanding. Ben Witherington, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Ben, we've heard a lot this week in Australia about evangelicalism. It's applied both to the Sydney Diocese of the Anglican Church, who are in the middle of a controversy in England, particularly through a meeting of Jerusalem, in which they are proposing that conservative elements of the Anglican Church split from the more liberal elements under the banner of evangelicalism. We're also hearing of groups in the Pentecostal arena who call themselves evangelical being accused of splitting families and charismatic performances. Evangelicalism seems a much used and abused term. How does one define it?
Well, it is. I would call it a many-splintered thing. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, that if you put four evangelicals in a room, you may get five definitions. That's really the truth about that. But the way that I would define it and really distinguish it from fundamentalism is that evangelicals are critically thinking conservative Protestants. That's who they are, as opposed to fundamentalists who really don't engage in critical thinking and don't really apply any of the modern scholarly approaches to the Bible in order to understand it. So there's a difference between fundamentalism and evangelicalism, even though both of those groups are conservative Protestants or one stripe or another.
Evangelicalism traces its roots back, though, to a certain point in the 18th century, doesn't it? Evangelicalism is as it's generally understood.
Well, yes, and part of the confusion is that when people hear the word evangelical and they're just sort of the general public, they think, oh, evangelistic people like Billy Graham or somebody like that, you know. But that would be the publicity wing of evangelicalism. Evangelicalism as a movement is a much larger thing that involves even major mainline denominations like the Anglican Church, like Baptists, like the Methodists, and all these different denominations that are not Catholic and not Orthodox, but rather Protestant. And so, you know, it's kind of hard to get your calipers around what an evangelical is, because some of them are in independent churches, some of them are in mainline churches like the Anglican Church, which are, you know, denominations that are more pluralistic in character and yet have many evangelical churches and evangelical individuals. But the heart of evangelicalism really has to do with the focus on the Bible as the Word of God, as the inspired Word of God, and, you know, certain non-negotiable essentials of the Christian faith that they're not really going to be debating or arguing about, chiefly Christological ideas about the virginal conception of Jesus, the bodily resurrection, the atoning death of Jesus, those kinds of things. I mean, that really is at the heart of evangelicalism, and a stress on a personal relationship with Jesus.
And that stress on a personal relationship also puts some emphasis on conversionism as well, that is, there is a proselytizing dimension.
Absolutely. Just today, the Pew Charitable Trust published their enormous 2007 survey of North American religion, in particular United States religion. And one of the interesting results, even in America, was that over half of the evangelicals surveyed said that they did not think that Jesus was the only way of salvation. Now, that's a shock. There were lots of other conclusions in the survey as well, because traditionally, evangelicalism has stressed that in a pluralistic world, there is a singular God who has offered a single way of salvation. So that poll result will certainly send shockwaves out of various, including the Sydney Diocese, I would think, among other things.
Well, so, it's a sign that really, with the rapid cultural shifts over the last 40 years in particular, evangelicalism itself is losing its hold on what it is at its core. It's as much culture as it is theology.
Well, absolutely it is. And on top of that, what's not helping that is some of the things that are most bringing people into evangelical churches. I mean, if you really look at the modern praise music movement, it's very light on theology and it's heavy on experience. And what happens when that happens, you know, where it's sort of big on affective side and not big on the cognitive side, is people don't end up much knowing what they believe. So you're right about that. I mean, you're absolutely right about that. The other interesting aspect of the survey that came out today was this, that people under the age of 30, whatever kind of church they may have come through, including conservative Protestants, were far less likely to be clear on their theological non-negotiables than people over 30. Now, that's very interesting as well, and I would put that down as well to the fact that the focus in the evangelical church has moved from the cognitive to the affective pretty much worldwide if we're talking about growing churches.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest is Dr. Ben Witherington III, Bible scholar and Professor of New Testament Interpretation at Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky, and something of an expert helping us guide our way through the many paths of evangelicalism around the world. Ben, let's have a piece of music. You are also broad and interesting in, when it comes to your musical choices, I noticed this evening, where everything from sort of classics to jazz. Let's have a little of Miles Davis from one of the great defining moments in the history of jazz, Kind of Blue from 1962, So What? Why have you chosen this little piece of music?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is that I'm from the hometown of John Coltrane, the greatest saxophone player ever. So he's a homeboy, and I love his music. But there's a reason why that music really says so much about American culture. That is, you have structure, but you have improvisation. And that actually is a really good definition of evangelicalism. It has structure, but it has lots of improvisation, and that's one of the reasons it's been able to shift with the cultural winds and grow and continue to do evangelism and mission successfully.
Miles Davis, Kinda Blue. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Dr. Ben Wetherington, from Asbury Theological Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. Asbury is one of the homes of evangelical scholarship in the United States. Ben Witherington is helping us unpack just what evangelicalism means. Ben Witherington, let's use Asbury as a model and talk about the four distinct strands that one can find in evangelicalism. Here in Australia, we're very familiar with the Sydney Anglicans calling themselves evangelical, yet they exhibit a very distinct form of evangelicalism, which is very much tied to the Reformed or Calvinist tradition, to a very strong propositional idea of the faith. At the same time, we have in Sydney also Hillsong, one of the leading charismatic churches in Australia, who are tied to a different form of evangelicalism entirely, and both of them sit very uncomfortably with each other.
Well, they do. And so here is the spectrum. On the one end of the spectrum, you have the Reformed tradition. And I have to tell you that when I was growing up, back at the dawn of time when the earth was still cooling in the 50s and 60s, when you heard the word evangelical in America, that almost always meant automatically somebody of a Reformed or Calvinistic theology. Okay? That's really not true anymore. What has happened in my lifetime is not that there weren't always other conservative Protestants out there. It's just that they now all like to call themselves evangelicals. Whereas when I was growing up, people of my heritage would be called Wesleyans, not evangelicals at all. So, you know, the big theological distinction is basically between Calvinists and Arminians. And if we're talking both worldwide and in North America, Arminians are by far more populous than Calvinists are, though you wouldn't know that by the sort of long rhetoric of the Calvinists.
Well, let's go back into this history a bit. Calvin and Arminius are two of the great figures of the Protestant Reformation. In fact, they had a fight, almost literally a fight, at the Synod of Dort in Holland many years ago. But it was essentially a fight over the nature of the sovereignty of God, was it not?
It was, and really about the character of God more than anything else. And the real issue more than anything else was, has God created a universe where there is a certain modicum of freedom for human beings to respond freely and without predetermination to salvation or not? I mean, that was the heart of the issue, whether that human beings created in the image of God had a certain modicum of freedom just as God has freedom. And that was really at the heart of the debate. Or was it the case that God had predetermined everything in advance of even creating the world, never mind saving the world? In which case, freedom has a very different meaning. It simply means I don't feel compulsed, but I couldn't have done otherwise anyway. And it's like the old famous joke of the Reformed minister and the Methodist minister going to a ministerial meeting, and they're in a hurry, and it's pouring rain, and they have to go down these slick steps to get into the meeting hall. And the Reformed one goes first, and he falls down the stairs, and he gets to the bottom and says, "Well, I'm sure glad that's over with." And then the Methodist comes right behind him, and he falls down the stairs and says, "You know, I've got to be more careful next time so that won't happen." I mean, that really kind of sums up the difference in those two theologies right there. One believes that everything is predetermined before the foundation of the world, and the other absolutely doesn't. And so what they disagree on is how God is almighty, not whether God is sovereign, but how he exercises his sovereignty.
Now, the great popularizer of the Arminian tradition, certainly in the West, is John Wesley, the man associated with the evangelical revival, and a man who actually brought Arminius, erudite Dutch scholar, into the hands of ordinary folk. It really transformed the world, in a sense. It was a religious revolution prior to the French Revolution.
It was, and it certainly changed. Coming at the same time as the rise of the Industrial Revolution in Britain, it couldn't have come at a better possible time. And it appealed to a lot of people's rising notions of freedom as well. So, I mean, you're right. I mean, it was something that came at a propitious moment in time. What's interesting about Wesley's take on Arminius is that Wesley doesn't simply walk in lockstep with Arminius. He really does his own sort of Anglican take on all of that. and presents it in a way that the ordinary person can both understand it and embrace it wholeheartedly. And it's one of the things that fueled him to say things like, the world is my parish. I mean, if you really believe that there's a world to be won and that God loves the world and not just the elect, then that's a strong impetus for evangelism and missions and a belief that God can use you to make a difference in both of those. And that's one of the things that really fueled the Wesleyan revival.
That revival took off across the world. It influenced the foundation of, even in Australia, it influences the foundation of a major city like Melbourne. It has huge cultural influence across the globe. And yet, after 150 years or so, even that began to run out of steam. It's also associated in people's mind, I guess, in the last year or so, with films like Amazing Grace and the work of the right. anti-slavery movement, Wilberforce. It has both a social and another worldly dimension. It's concerned about both this world and the next. How do we explain that? How does Wesley get to do that?
Well, Wesley was famous for saying there is no spiritual gospel without the social gospel, and there is no social gospel without the spiritual gospel. God's interested in redeeming both the body and the spirit, both the heart and the mind. And so his view was that salvation involves sanctification. And sanctification involved not just the reform of your heart, but the reform of your behavior, of what he called your manners, your whole demeanor. It's at the heart of what God wants of us, that we love our neighbor as ourself. Then that's an implicit manifesto for a social gospel right there. And so certainly that's always been, at the forefront of working out the implications of one's salvation from an Arminian and Wesleyan point of view.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. Let's have a little music now that reflects probably something of the great breadth of church tradition in which we are all together, both in the present reality and in the past. Vaughan Williams, great arrangement of For All the Saints. Ben, why have you chosen this one?
Well, I grew up on the piano bench and in church music, sang in choirs. I was actually a cantor in a church as well. And this is certainly of modern hymns. And when I say modern hymns written in the latter half of the 20th century, this is one of the great hymns written in the 20th century. And when I for sure want at my funeral, whenever that day comes, it's a great, great hymn that reminds us that we are all connected to the centuries of all the Christian saints, and we stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us.
For All the Saints. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia and around the world on the World Wide Web, www.abc.net.au/Sunday Nights. You can podcast the program as well. So if you've missed something of what Ben Witherington has had to say thus far or wish to catch up with the rest, get it on your pod. Ben Witherington, we've traced the emergence of evangelicalism through Arminius and Wesley. You come to the beginning of the 20th century, and it seems to fracture in a whole lot of ways. Again, I guess America is seminal to this. In the years following the Civil War, there seems to be a fracturing of evangelicalism. You get a rather pessimistic strand against the Wesleyan optimistic strand. Just explain this for us.
Well, let's go back to 1820 if we can, because one of the strands we haven't actually mentioned yet is the dispensational strand. And so where we actually have to go to, is to a revival meeting, actually an Arminian revival meeting, if I'm thinking straight, that was being held in Glasgow in Scotland. And there was a young girl there named Margaret MacDonald. She was a teenage girl who was deeply affected by the revival meeting and claimed to have a vision of a rapture of the church out of the world. Now, the reason this is significant is that there was a certain minister by the name of Darby there, who in turn was one of the founders of a denomination called the Plymouth Brethren, who were going to have an influence out of all proportion to the size of what was going to be the denomination. What she claimed was that though the world was going to spiral down into a huge conflagration and tribulation, that God was going to exempt the church for that at the crucial moment by beaming it up to heaven. And at that juncture, various bad things would go down on earth. And the prophecies of the Old Testament that were meant strictly for Israel would be fulfilled while the church was sort of out of bounds or out of play, so to speak. Now, this was the beginning of what is called today dispensationalism. And
this is the whole rapture thing that's embraced by books in the 60s like Hal Lindsey's Late Great Planet Earth and these days Tim LaHaye and the Left Behind series, all of that.
All of that stuff. All of that stuff, yes. And it came out of, it did, the idea in Christendom did not exist before 1820, so far as I can see.
This would be a surprise to many hundreds of thousands in Pentecostal churches around the world.
Well, exactly. I mean, I just did a major meeting in Singapore for Methodists, Aldersgate Convention for Methodists, and I actually, and this rapture theology is huge in the Asian church, all over the Asian church, whether you're in Hong Kong or Singapore or Malaysia, wherever you are. And, you know, I actually had a minister, an elderly minister, stand up and say, "What is this novel idea? You're telling us there's not going to be any rapture. This is not evangelical theology." And I then proceeded to tell him the history of dispensationalism, which doesn't even go back to the time of John Wesley in the 18th century, and explained to him that it was a lay movement which was begun by a teenage girl and followed up by D.L. Moody, who was the Billy Graham of his day, and Darby, who was a minister in England. And then there was Scofield, who promulgated this theology in the Scofield Reference Bible. And finally, in the 20th century, you've had popularizers, as you mentioned, like Hal Lindsey or Timothy LaHaye or John Wolvert or all of those sorts of folks. What's interesting about this theology is it's not a theology that was created by theologians. It's a lay theology that really has spanned the globe and taken over large parts of the evangelical world.
Do you think that's a cultural thing? That is, the 20th century was a particularly tough century. One wasn't inclined to optimism. It's sort of that right. Pessimism has an appeal, that it's all too tough here and we're going to be okay in the next world?
Well, here's what you can certainly say about this theology. Whenever times have gotten rough, the truth of the matter is that, in fact, people have embraced theological comfort food. And one form of theological comfort food says, "Beam me up, Scotty." You know, when the going gets tough, it's time to get out of here. And so this theology has played especially well during wars or depressions or recessions and things like that. It's interesting to track the sales of the Scofield Reference Bible and some of these bestsellers. When do they really start selling? When things get really going bad and people are looking for a way out. So, you know,
it's, yes, I guess it's a bit like the phenomenon of when people during the Depression, say in the 1930s, you had that rise in the sort of popular Hollywood escapist fantasies as well in movies. That is, that sort of popular light comedies, all of those things take off when you need to escape tough times.
Well, exactly. And another thing that has fueled this trend really is the increasing radical individualism of Western culture and even the narcissism of Western culture. Now, if salvation is all about my private relationship with God or with Jesus and my private future as well, then, you know, me being personally beamed up into heaven, regardless if the world is going to Hades in a handbasket, is a vision of the afterlife or the future that's easy for a radical individualist to embrace. Much harder to embrace if you think you have got an obligation to take up your cross and follow Jesus and suffer with your fellow Christians who are busy being martyred or suffering around the world. It really is a theology that doesn't place at the heart of the gospel, take up your cross and follow Jesus. It doesn't embrace suffering. It doesn't see suffering as potentially redemptive. I mean, there are all these problems with this theology. But it certainly plays well in Western culture that wants to hear a health and wealth gospel.
That's interesting that it's both pessimistic about the future of this world, but very optimistic about your place within it. That is, you can better get the best out of it you can at the moment. That all of God's promises don't apply to the world, they apply to you.
Well, exactly. It's a carpe diem theology. It's, you know, I'm in God's Bless Me Club, and if I've just got enough faith and trust well enough, you know, health and wealth can be mine right now. And, of course, what that totally forgets is the whole history of the church, which has been a history of repeated suffering and martyrdom for the sake of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, is it really the case that they, people like Peter and Paul, had not enough faith? Why is it that God told Paul that his thorn in the flesh needed to remain because his power was made perfect in Paul's weakness? Why was that? Well, see, that's a theology that doesn't appeal to people who want theological comfort food. That's a theology that requires sacrifice and less individualism and less self-centered behavior.
Given that, you so accurately describe this phenomenon, given that it has become almost the default position for much of popular Christianity in the world, one could be led to a rather pessimistic assessment of the future of Christianity if this becomes the default position across the globe for much of what contemporary Christianity is.
But here's the other side of this. The majority of dispensationalists are Calvinists, and so for them, you know, they think this is how it was supposed to be. You know, I have a T-shirt that I love to wear that says, "I was destined to be a Wesleyan," you know, which is a joke because I don't really believe that. I believe there was a matter of personal response there. But, you know, if you're a person who believes that everything has been predetermined by God from before the foundation of the world, then, you know, you're going to say things like, well, this was inevitable. This was bound to happen. My behavior is not going to make any difference about this one way or another. I just need to be faithful to God and continue reading my Bible and doing my devotions. And, you know, if things get really bad and we actually get to the tribulation, well, God's just going to beam us on out of here and all will be found. We'll be fine. So I don't need to go try and rescue the world or solve the problem of poverty or anything like that. I can just concentrate on my own individual salvation and leave the rest in God's hands.
You're on Sunday Night. Ben Witherington, let's have a little relief from this pessimism and leap back to a broader Catholic theology from the Red Monk of Venice, who gained his reputation musically by teaching young schoolgirls about the love and wonder of creation. A little bit of Vivaldi, Spring.
Thank you.
Spring from the Four Seasons. Ben Witherington, why'd you choose that?
Well, besides the fact that I love Baroque music, anyway, it's really the joie de vivre of the music. It really expresses, as you suggested, an optimism, a trust in the life that God has given you and the goodness of the life that God has given you, and that it deserves to be celebrated, that life is supposed to be about doxology. It's not supposed to be about, let's worry about what the next thing that can go wrong will be. So I think this music really expresses the joy of the gift of life.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you, my guest, Dr. Ben Witherington III, a biblical scholar at Asbury Seminary in the United States, and unpacking for us some of the mysterious territory called evangelicalism. Ben Witherington, the most popular expression of what's called broadly evangelicalism today seems to be found in the independent charismatic churches, the Pentecostal churches, as they've come to be known around the world.
Absolutely, and especially in places like South America, where the church that is growing most rapidly, like a huge vine crawling over a tree, is Pentecostalism, no question.
Yet these churches at another level seem to be the most disconnected churches. That is, every one is almost independent of every other one unless they choose to associate. So you get a variety of teachings within these churches. What holds them together?
Experience. The affirmation of the gifts and the fruit of the Spirit and the raucous praise of God in a bolder and noisy way. The heart of the matter is dramatic experiences in the Holy Spirit. It's what, you know, is the common denominator of all these different kinds of churches. Now, here's an interesting thing about these churches. I mean, I was preaching at one of these kinds of churches outside of Philadelphia. One of the things that is true about these churches is that because of the focus not on a particular ethnic heritage or denominational heritage or even a particular cognitive heritage, these churches have an easier time crossing boundaries and breaking down boundaries. I mean, this particular church I was preaching in, it was 30% Indian that had migrated to America. It was 30% African-American black. It was 30% white. And then there was another 10% of Asians. I mean, it was an absolute rainbow coalition of a church. And all of them were sharing in this common. What brought them all there like a magnet was dynamic worship and sharing in this spiritual experience together. So one of the things that has caused a huge fueling of these denominations worldwide is that it seems to break down many of the social barriers, like ethnicity, that have divided Christians traditionally in various parts of the world.
And breaks down certain theological barriers as well. That is, it doesn't matter
Correct.
So much what you believe, is how you experience it.
Well, that's true up to a point. I mean, Pentecostals, there aren't any Calvinist Pentecostals as far as I know. Very few, anyway. Most of the Pentecostal churches, like the Church of God of the Prophecy, the Assemblies of God, all of these charismatic denominations, even the very independent ones, the ones that are simply called Pentecostal or Pentecostal Holiness churches, they're all offshoots of Arminian Christianity, going back to the end of the 19th century with the large wave of holiness revivals and then the Azusa Street charismatic revival in L.A. in the beginning of the 20th century. So they really are a form of Arminian Christianity with a particular emphasis on experience.
But they also have a strong strand of dispensationalism in them, which you suggest in its origins or its sentiments, it has a strong Calvinist element into it.
It does, and that's very interesting, isn't it? Because what happens there is they like the rapture theology, but they don't like the predetermination, especially because they believe that, you know, they have some choice about even what spiritual gifts they get. And so they've embraced some of dispensationalism, but not all of it, which is very interesting. I mean, the Zionistic aspect of it, you're actually more likely to find in the Pentecostal churches than in some of the Reformed churches. And that's very interesting. In other words, a whole heart embracing of the modern nation of Israel as sort of sacrosanct, and you know, your nation's supposed to be supporting them and all of that sort of stuff.
Which brings us to the political and social impact of these churches, particularly in the United States. That is, you're describing a contemporary popular evangelicalism, which has shed itself of its theological roots, is very strong on experience, and that experience tends to play into people's particular cultural sentiments or even prejudices.
Well, that's certainly true, and in the Pew survey I was referring to earlier in the program, one of the clear correlations, which we already instinctively knew, but which was reaffirmed in this detailed survey, was that people who tend to be theologically conservative also tend to be socially and politically conservative as well in North America. Now, that's not necessarily true around the world. For example, in South Africa, many of the evangelical Protestants were anti-apartheid. I mean, especially most of my Methodist friends, like Bishop Story, that came out of that, who were thoroughly evangelical Protestants, were on the front lines against apartheid from day one. So, you know, it's interesting that the least socially active on the whole, and the clearest correlation between political conservatism and religious conservatism can be seen in a place like North America, but not so much in other places.
This is changing, and well, I guess that's just saying the bleeding obvious, but you're getting what's emerging in the United States and in other places of a phenomenon amongst evangelicals and others called the emerging church movement, Brian
right.
McLaren and others, and they seem to right. be suggesting that the way to find a way forward is for actually everyone to understand their particular tradition at depth and then begin to connect with what they have in common. Is this in some ways a reaction to the shallowness of popular evangelicalism?
I think that's partly the truth. And one of the things that I said in my book, The Problem with Evangelical Theology, is, isn't it interesting that these various different strands of evangelicalism are theologically weakest in their distinctives? Now, isn't that interesting? In other words, they have the strongest biblical support and the most theological support for the things they actually share in common with one another. This is also something Brian McLaren has said, and my book was to try and show that that's theologically clear if you analyze through a biblical sifting these different traditions of where are their strengths and weaknesses. In each case, it's the distinctives of those particular brands of theology that are least biblically centered or focused. And I think there, in the 21st century, there is an increasing awareness of this, especially of people in conservative churches or having joined conservative churches who are under the age of 40 or even under the age of 30. I mean, one of the big phenomena in North America right now is Rob Bell and his whole version of the emerging or emergent church movement. And one of the strengths of what he's doing, like Brian McLaren, is that the social gospel is loud and clear there. They're very concerned about AIDS in Africa and poverty and malaria nets and all of those sorts of things.
And that, too, is beginning to have its influence across a number of these Pentecostal and charismatic churches, whether it be for the sake of show or for substance. They're beginning to identify with the need to have some dimension, at least, of a social gospel associated with them.
Well, a good example of a transformation would be Rick Warren, the founder of the huge megachurch Saddleback in California. Initially and essentially, this was just another megachurch of an evangelical flavor that was very independent. But what happened with Rick Warren was increasingly he became uncomfortable with a purely spiritual gospel and became more and more concerned about AIDS and relief of world debt in third world countries and all those sorts of things. And to great criticism from many members of his own church, he started hosting conferences on this in his own church. So one of the things that has happened in the sort of megachurch movement in evangelicalism is an uneasy social conscience that's led to changes and transformations.
Ben Witherington, it's been great to have you with us. We've run out of time. You've given us a great deal to think about. We're going to finish with another piece of music, and this one is perhaps one of those bellwether songs. Tommy by Pete Townshend, performed by The Who, 1969. This is where, coming out of the 60s, a lot of the churches began to find that things weren't holding together, and where experience, I guess, began to take over from theology because it resonated with the cultural moment.
It did, and it also resonates with where the church is today, because the essential heart cry of Tommy was calling out to anyone, including God, see me, feel me, touch me, heal me. This is what the world is crying out for, and it's part of the heartbeat of evangelical theology.
Ben Witherington, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Deaf, dumb and blind boy, sure poet plays mean pinball. The overture from Tommy, a selection of our guest, Ben Witherington III. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. Coming up after the news, the Inquisition on Sunday nights.